our student representative to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Are there agenda deletions, additions, or changes of sequence?
I would just like to point out that item 8.3.6, I believe, listed had previously been listed on the agenda as Resolution 47-15-16, and that is incorrect. It's Resolution 46-15-16. There's no change to the actual resolution or the information of the item, just a change to the resolution number.
Thank you. Uh-huh.
And I'd like to move that we move item 8.3.5 to 8.3.2. Is there people from the public and staff here to speak to it?
Before 8.3.2?
Yes.
And will you tell me the number again? 8.3.5. Great, thank you. Superintendent remarks prior to public comments. This is the time for public comment. These are for members of the public to speak to the board on issues that are not on the agenda. Are there any members of the public that would like to speak to the board? Okay. Superintendent report.
Good evening. I want to extend a special thank you to the Santa Cruz Education Foundation for another wonderful Emmy Awards celebration this last week. I'm tremendously grateful to our guest partners who and their work to recognize and celebrate teachers, support staff, and community partnerships that makes our schools really exceptional. It's one of my favorite nights of the year. I also like to congratulate Santa Cruz High School staff and leadership team for a successful WASP visit and 6-year accreditation. Special thanks to Steve Cokehall, Michelle Hubbard, and Stacey Newsom Kerr for leading that self-study process. This Sunday is the annual Gala Guest House celebration. If you come to Harbor High School, it's a wonderful celebration of Indigenous culture, music, dance, language, and food and the arts, and you have a ticket on the dais in front of you, and we welcome you to join us for that event. It's an incredible collaboration between district staff, volunteers, and parents, and if you come, it's always really important to them that we have you come up and have you introduced, so please make sure that you give me a call on my cell phone. I'll be around at one of the entrances or walking around somewhere because I know they're going to want to make sure that they have a chance to introduce you to the community. Gold Ribbon Awards ceremony, we've celebrated before, but I want to recognize that this last week we had the official state awards ceremony for our 4 comprehensive elementary schools, all of whom were recognized, which is really significant as Gold Ribbon schools. And in addition to the Gold Ribbon recognition, Bayview and Galt were recognized as Title I achieving schools, and Westlake was recognized as an arts achieving school. Very, very, very impressive. This last Wednesday, I met with Supervisor Coonerty, and we talked a bit about our facilities master planning work. And I solicited his input on our plans and the work that we're doing. I appreciate continued support from all of our elected representatives. Last Friday, principals, coaches, RTI coordinators were all engaged in some initial professional development planning for next year. So we had a bunch of folks in the room talking together about planning next steps for professional learning. And we'll continue that work with skill leaders and sites to refine the processes and planning for next year.
Thank you, Chris. Student representative report.
Hello, everybody. The Harbor High play wrapped up last weekend to great success. We were sold out on the closing night. And then the final theater performances of the year, the cabaret, the first tryouts were today, and then they are also on Friday at lunch. AP testing is wrapping up this week. And I believe the final tests that any students are taking are happening tomorrow. And I would really like to congratulate Chris Carlson for her Teacher of the Year from the Eddy, and Judith Mayer for her work with GSE and the Grad School Program at Harvard. Both of them have done a lot this year and many years before, and their work shows around campus.
Oh, sorry. Board member reports?
I will submit my report to Nancy later. Good evening. I also attended the Eddy Awards, and it just makes me so proud to be a part of San Francisco Schools and to have my children in San Francisco Schools every time I go to the award ceremony. I also have been to the third of our ad hoc facilities meetings, and we're having some really rich and interesting conversations about thinking about our facilities and what we could and need to do.
Mike Weirman was a Vietnam veteran who saw the horrific government lies and the terror of that era. And I think that's at least in part what prompted him to make a home for himself at Bayview, and where he was the kickball facilitator extraordinaire, the janitor, the custodian. But from about 1980 to almost 2005, he was just the heart and soul of that school, along with, of course, Dan Cavanaugh and some of the other great teachers. And so he passed away recently, and I was so touched to go to Bayview for his memorial and to hear all the old-timers speak, Freya Kidner and Margaret Eisenstein and Dan. It was just a wonderful experience. And it's funny that leaders of the school may not necessarily be teachers. They may not necessarily be administrators. In this case, it was Mike who was a classified employee. But really, he was much more than that. And, well, you just had to know him. It was a very important time, and it was good to be here. Thank you.
Nancy, with your permission, I'll submit my report. Thank you.
Well, I went to the Santa Cruz Art League's All-Student Art Show, and all of our high schools were well represented, including Delta and Costa Nova. We had lots of awards, and it just shows how alive the arts are in our district. I encourage you to go if you have a chance. I also enjoyed the Eddy Awards. This is my eighth Eddy Award that I went to, and the opportunity to acknowledge the wonderful work of our teachers and the wonderful programs that we have and community partners, really valuable event. I went to the Delta Open House. They have 21 students who have received scholarships to Cabrillo College, so that's pretty exciting.
Hi. I also want to give a shout-out to Santa Cruz High for their accreditation. It was really great that they got the six-year accreditation, and I know they worked very hard at it, so bravo to them. I attended the Ad Hoc Facilities Committee meeting this past week, and as Dee Dee said, it's really interesting because our job is to try to open up possibilities, and there's a danger with that sometimes rumors get around the community that we're doing this and we're doing that, when it's just been ideas that we've wanted to try out. So we're not in the position of trying to make decisions for the entire community. We're trying to stretch our brains, and it's been really interesting and fun to do so. I went to the Ed Foundation also, and I also was so impressed by the enthusiasm of the teachers that we had there. And I was impressed by there were several male teachers that got an award, and I just thought, well, in a time when it sometimes it seems like in the whole country as a whole, we're going kind of a little backwards. The males got up and really had no problem with saying how touched they were by teaching and how sometimes it brought them to tears, and how important that was to them, that they could express what it felt like. And often they came from a family of teachers, so they gave a shout out to grandmothers and aunts and mothers and fathers who had been teachers. It was really just a great thing to see, and I appreciated it. I want to encourage you to go to, I'm not sure I can say this right,
Galagetza.
Okay, I should know that. But I went last year at the last minute because I didn't realize it had come, and I got to tell you, if you like mole, you have to go. I mean, it was unbelievable. I really was wishing that I could actually eat a whole lot more than I could possibly eat. It was so good. The music was so good. The dancing was great. So I would really highly recommend it to anybody. I felt like I had just kind of arrived in Oaxaca for a little vacation, which, you know, was nice. And it wasn't as hot. Finally, I found out that I do have permission to say this, so I'm just going to say that I've made the decision to run again for the school board because my term is about up. So just let everybody know that. That's it.
Okay, I had the good fortune of being able to attend two celebrations, the Eddie Awards. I was very moved and inspired and cried and did all that good stuff, and also the Blue Ribbon Awards. And I'm delighted to be part of a district that is so committed to excellence and to recognizing excellence, particularly in teachers who frequently go unnoticed. I did attend the Harbor High musical a few times. And I want to definitely commend and do a shout out to an exceptional teacher, Kathy Warner, for the work that she does to build student leadership in the drama department of Harbor High. It is exceptional. And it's also a nice relaxing to be finished with the musical at our house. I attended the De La Viega parent meeting, and I wanted to let people know that next Wednesday, which is the 18th, will be the first meeting of the Santa Cruz City School LGBT Task Force. We have about 15 people across different community groups, teachers, administrators coming together to talk about how to best support our LGBT students. So I'm excited to be able to attend that meeting next Wednesday. And if anybody is interested in coming, let me know and I will let you know where it is.
Did you say Wednesday or Thursday?
Wednesday at 4 p.m. I think it's going to be at Harbor, but I still need to confirm. So if somebody's interested in attending, let me know, and I'll send you an email about the location for sure. And I'll let the board know. Okay, it's time to approve the minutes. Do we have a motion for the regular meeting on April 20th?
Move. I'll second.
Do we have a student recommendation?
Aye.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain?
Thank you.
And now for the study session on April 20th, 2016. Do we have a motion?
Move to approve.
Thank you.
Second.
Beauty and Claudia?
Abstain.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? 7-0. And then finally for the joint board budget advisory council
committee.
Meeting on April 27th.
Move approval.
Second.
Student and all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, that's 7-0. I'm sorry. It's time for the consent agenda. The consent agenda is for matters that are considered non-controversial that can be passed in one roll call motion. Are there any items on the consent agenda that the board would like to pulled for discussion?
Madam Chair?
Oh, 1 second. We'll get to public comment for consent. Are there questions from the board about the consent agenda? Is there anybody that would like to speak in public
Could
comment?
I ask for a clarification of 8.1922? I don't need to know what the details are, but the financial details, but if you could give me a clarification, I'd appreciate that. Is Mr. Maxfield moving out or what?
No, this is a renewal of a lease for Burroughs. It's a renewal of a lease.
Oh, it's a renewal.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any other public comment on any other items on the consent agenda? Okay, do we have a motion?
Move approval.
Second.
Claudia and Sheila.
Thank you.
And student recommendation?
Aye.
This is a roll call.
Aye.
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 Aye. Reports of actions taken in closed session, Claudia? Did I forget something? No.
Nope. Okay, the Board of Trustees took action on certificated, classified, and management leaves, retirements, resignations, and appointments. Robert Shemwell was appointed Assistant Superintendent of Business Services. The Board of Trustees heard an update and provided Assistant Superintendent Molly Parks with direction regarding GSCFT negotiations. The Board of Trustees heard an update regarding a final settlement agreement, special education.
Okay. First agenda item is 8.3.1, a celebration.
Tonight we're here to celebrate an amazing program school that we've had in our community for the last 27 years. So I'm going to start with Lisa.
How many?
It's only 97 years old.
So,
yeah.
That's right. So I'm going to turn it over to Lisa to do a quick honoring of a student, and then we'll honor our staff that's here with us tonight.
Hi, I'm Lisa Kabashi. Is this on? Do I need this?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, just checking. I'm principal for Santa Cruz Adult School and co-principal for support small schools, and I'm really happy that we have this opportunity to acknowledge the hard work of Santa Cruz Adult School and recognize its new incarnation that is coming. And we're going to start by me not knowing what's going on. Good. Now you can really hear me. Yes? Sorry. We're going to start by honoring two of our students, and I'd like to introduce Rebecca Weber, who has been with the adult school for 37 years. She's currently teaching GED prep and helping people get their high school diploma. And she is going to acknowledge our student honoree and share a student testimonial. Thank you. Good evening.
I also teach HISET High School Equivalency. And I'd like to introduce a graduate of the program, Samantha Threw.
Thank you.
She just received her HISET, which is high school equivalency degree. She passed all of her tests and is ready to start her college career at Cabrillo. She's enrolled already. She did not waste a minute of the time doing that. I nominated her, and she was accepted as this year's recipient of the California Adult Education Student Succeed Award. With this, her story will be publicized in a variety of local and statewide sites in the form of a video, and she'll be receiving a plaque commemorating her achievement at their annual conference held in November in San Diego. So when I read of the criteria for this award, I knew Samantha was perfect. She fit every qualification. And it read, the nominee is an adult with significant life responsibilities, such as those related to employment, has made positive contributions to the community as an adult education student and community member, has established and met life goals as a result of attending adult education program, has improved the life situation of self and others as a result of this learning experience, has overcome difficult circumstances in order to pursue adult learning experiences. And Samantha was just a great inspiration and motivation to everyone in the classroom. She was the first of this semester to graduate and just was encouraging and just had the biggest heart anybody I know. She is going to go on to study out at Cabrillo and pursue higher education with the goal of working with the disabled and elderly as a social worker. So she's going to be a great contributor to our community, as she is already. So with that, Samantha, I just made up an adult school certificate for you, but better things are to come. Mm-hmm. And you didn't bring tissues with this. Okay. First off, I'm really owe everything of my school year to you. The encouragement that she gave, she allowed me just to be creative, be the person I am, study in my own way so that I could pass and so that I could, you know, go on to lead a better, fuller life. I've raised my 6 kids. Some of you know them, troops. But I really owe a lot to my teacher here. You know, you were my inspiration. You had faith in me when I had no faith in myself. And you, the staff, they all were 100% supportive behind us. They really do support and encourage any way that we can figure out how to study and how to better succeed in the fields that we wish to become. And I owe a great deal to the Santa Cruz Adult Education System. And I thank you. And I thank you. And I have one other thing. I have a student in my class, Alejandra Santiago, who she's a GED student now, but she in 1990 started her path with ESL classes at adult school. So she came in with a letter. She couldn't be here today, but she wanted me to read this. And so I'm going to. It's very well written, by the way. In January 1990, I arrived in Santa Cruz from a small village in the state of Oaxaca, Mexico. I was running from prejudice and poverty. The same month, I met a very nice family who registered me at the Santa Cruz Adult School. One evening at 6:30 p.m., I walked into a classroom then located on Taylor Street. I brought with me a pencil, notebook, and the fear of a new language. Already in the classroom, I sat down, and a few minutes later, this lady walked into the room and said something. I only understood Tony Miras. I thought, oh, this English thing is going to be hard. Tony taught me these two phrases. English is easy for me, and please speak more slowly. I really enjoyed the time I spent in ESL classes. I had several teachers. I have all of them in my heart. Between work and daily living, I was able to learn English, and thanks to the teachers who encouraged me to move forward with my learning, I went to Cabrillo College. I remember when a teacher at the adult school told me, you should go to Cabrillo. I thought this teacher is crazy. College is for smart people. Mm-hmm. But guess what? I did go to Cabrillo and got a medical assistant with honors certificate. With honors, wow. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought of me being smart? Oh, yes, the teachers at the adult school. At the present time, I am in a documentary about my life as an immigrant in the United States, and soon I will open my own business. And again, who made this all possible? The Santa Cruz Adult School. I would never be able to pay back what the adult school has done for me. I want to thank all the teachers for their patience, kindness, and encouragement. They are full of wisdom. Sincerely, Alejandra Santiago. So a special tribute to the ESL teachers.
And now we're going to turn our celebration over to Molly Parks. So I don't know what else to say after those two amazing representation of the work that's been done at the adult school. As I said, over the last 97 years, the adult school has been open since 1919 here in Santa Cruz. It began by teaching ESL to Chinese immigrants, and ESL has always been one of the biggest programs there in the adult school. In its height, it served about 10,000 students a year from about 35 different areas around our community. When the school was this size, there were about 80 teachers and 10 staff working together. The students, as Samantha is a prime example, have gone to Cabrillo four-year universities and have succeeded in many, many areas in their lives. The reason for this, you heard, is the staff. The staff has supported all students at all times in whatever area they were learning and growing in. We'd like to really thank, though, one particular staff member, Hermanita. Hermanita began working in the adult school in 1982 after being in the district since 1973. But her work, her commitment has been to the adult school and the students, and I know how much they love, respect, and appreciate the work that's done by Hermanita as well as other staff members. Another huge program has been our parent co-op programs. Our parent co-op group have made many, many memories for many students and families throughout our entire community for many years. We know that the parents that have learned there, along with their students, have grown to be our PTA presidents and our other community involved in their students' lives for many, many years. So as we move forward, with some newfound funding and regulations for the state, it's time for our adult school to transform to a new chapter, a new beginning in our Santa Cruz Adult Ed. We'll be merging with Watsonville's Aptos Adult Ed as of July 1st. So we want to take this time to celebrate and thank the community, the teachers, the staff for their continued support, for the many students that have walked through the doors, whether they be preschoolers, whether they be immigrants, whether they be people interested in taking art, whatever it may be, that they were welcomed and found a home in our adult school. So we'd like to ask some folks to come up and be recognized. Yeah, we'll have you come up here to the front.
And stay.
Yeah. Barbara Burke. Corey Turk. Some of our co-op teachers here. The famous Hermanita Clark.
Thank you.
Laura Coleman. Maggie Clough. Irene Pacheco. Dara Thornton. Miss Lisa Foxton. Rebecca Wright. Wendy Wyckoff. Did we miss anyone else? Yay. So come right to center here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
there's some cake in the back. We're going to take just about a 2-minute quick break here, board. Get some cake out, and then we'll adjourn back.
2 minutes? It's going to be 2 minutes.
Okay.
Can I get anyone a piece of cake?
Thank you.
going to tap it. I don't like to compete with chocolate, but we really do need to begin. Okay.
So at this point of the year, we've gone through our layoff process, and I bring forward to you a resolution of a reduction of services for a final layoff of a 0.33 ART in for the 2016-2017 school year. So the process that we go through to come up with these resolutions, we start with our master schedules, and back before March 15th is our first deadline that we need to reach. And at that point, we laid off approximately 6 FTE. We were able to reduce it down to 0.33. We've worked through the process of negotiating and being the teachers being representative by their union, working with the union to reduce the layoffs as much as possible. And due to the master schedules and the declining enrollment, we were not able to fill this portion of this position.
I just want to add that, you know, lots of the reductions, we were able to eliminate lots of the reductions because people chose to take leaves or retired or resigned. And as that process happens and as we tighten up the master schedules to actuals with for a school site, that this is what we're left with at this point.
Are there questions from the board?
Are there comments from the public?
Hi, my name is Rini Gallagher, and I was asked to read this by a friend, Peggy Curtis, a parent
and she has could not be here this evening. And then I would also like to say something for myself as well. To whom it may concern, really, how dare you take away any more from any school? It's repulsive. These classes are just as important as any other offering and education and future to students. They gain an understanding of how the world works and how hard creativity is. As the parent of an award-winning art student, I know this is why I kept my daughter in school. This is what kept my daughter in school. If you want to save money, then stop the ridiculousness of retaking of math classes that have inferior teachers making students repeat and repeat classes. That's where the money goes. Don't take away classes that offer a future. They keep students interested in school. The high school experience, all 4 years, is vital to young people. We are raising adults, not children. My daughter was one of the students that would have left school early. I camped in the counseling office in order to get her into these marvelous art classes. At age 15, her art was best of show at the Santa Cruz County Fair. She has since been commissioned and paid for her art. She has been offered a position at a jewelry company in Berkeley. What more can you ask of a school than to offer a young adult a future? I'm ashamed of you for even considering these class closures. I have bragged so much about the wonderful and diverse art department with fantastic teachers that guide our young adults' creative futures. What better way to graduate from Santa Cruz High School than to know who you are? Know you're an artist. Know yourself. Go off into the world with a worldview. I have urged parents to send their kids to Santa Cruz High. Now I have to reconsider this if this is your trend. Sincerely, Peg Hart. I've had three children, and my husband taught at Santa Cruz High for 27 years. I did child care for 27 years, and I've been an advocate for mental health. Young adults and mid-age adults that have graduated from Santa Cruz High over the years. And I have to say that the art is what saves so many of these kids after graduation. The amount of stress that they go through now, it's nothing like we have. And it's just overwhelming. And the arts are just imperative to keep a lot of them alive. And to... I know it's a hard choice for you, but this is something that is for the mental health of our community and for our young adults and our community. And it's not just about, you know, having art classes or having this other class. It is what makes us human, and it helps us to have these children be able to live. And if this is something that they only really have, I have been an advocate for many. Our oldest daughter is bipolar. Art is what helped her through. She's 45 years old now. There are a number of children, young adults, that graduated from Santa Cruz High in her class that were diagnosed with different mental illnesses, and I have helped them and mentored them through the mental health part of Santa Cruz community, the mental health unit, and helped them get into medication or get them the help that they needed. But the art, they always came back to the art. They always came back to the art. I encourage you, and I just strongly implore you to rethink any class in any of the arts. It's not just another class. It is lifesaving. It is life. Thank you.
Are there other members of the public who would like to speak?
It's just an honor to be here. First off, it's great to be here to see how this runs. I've been in this for 4 weeks, so it's really cool to see how it runs. I'd like to recognize my wife, Julie. Do I need to use this, or can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
I'd like to recognize my wife, Julie Nolte. I guess her school, Westlake, was honored tonight for the arts program for the Golden Ribbon Award for excellence in art. So I'd just like to take an opportunity to congratulate her for doing that. And just to hear as we speak and hear from different people how art is so important to our school district and to the city schools of Santa Cruz. I'm a parent as well. I have two kids that are at Santa Cruz High. So I've watched them go through elementary through high school. I have a sophomore who has had the privilege of taking Miss Bear's photography class. I asked her today, I said, "Tell me something about Lindsay Bear," and she just said, "Yeah, that's my favorite teacher. I had such a good time in her class." And my father's a photographer, professional photographer, and just comparing what she learned in that class to what she taught was pretty amazing. And to see the photos that she came up with, just amazing. The part that saddens me is just, I am a full supporter of Measure O and Measure P. And I had sign in my yard, went to my neighbors, and I just expressed how important it is to pass these measures. Part of those measures include continued visual and performing arts enrichment, to attract and retain highly qualified teachers, to preserve art and music instruction. So if we sit here tonight and hear that a 0.33% is what needs to be cut, it's kind of disheartening. To work so hard for our community to get them to pass these measures, and then to have something like this that affects not only me personally, but my family and our community for art, it's kind of disheartening. And so, and I know you've all received different letters of support of this proposal, of cutting these people, of cutting this 0.33%. Is that right, 0.33? It's just disheartening. It's almost hard to go to my neighbors and tell them, you know, this is the kind of stuff they don't hear when there's cuts. And so for this to be an 8-year plan, without 8-year support, and this is the first year we're into it, and we're already getting cuts to what that measure was all about, is disheartening. And I just wanted to express that to you tonight, and hopefully the board. One last thing. I'm asking the board to direct the superintendent to re-examine this for a better outcome. As elected officials, it is your responsibility, and you are answerable to the community, and the superintendent is answerable to you. I ask you to re-examine the cutting of this 0.33% and to re-examine it. Thank you for your time.
So, Barry Kirshen for the Federation, and it's a sad time of the year, every year. We've had years where there were over 50 FTE laid off in the certificated ranks, and this year it's one-third of an FTE, and it's just as hard because it represents a person whose job is being lost, and it represents a community who's losing that person. And I think that the community has expressed outrage and concern about this loss at Westlake. We were hoping that there'd be some unexpected attrition or recalculation with the master schedules, and that by now the district would have found a way to restore that 0.33. If it becomes final tonight, we'll still be hoping that those enrollment projections are wrong. And if we see more students than were projected in the fall at Santa Cruz High, the right thing to do would be to restore the 0.33 at Westlake and undo the involuntary transfer that Santa Cruz High is losing. So I'd like for folks to keep that in mind. And things do have a way of shaking out over the next few months, and I'm still hopeful that we'll be restoring Lindsay back to Santa Cruz High and restoring Wesley back to a full-time art teacher.
Hi, Tim Hanson speaking on behalf of the Westlake PTA and the parent community. Westlake as a school has been blessed with some fantastic art teachers over the year, and Julie Nolte certainly filled some large shoes. And those efforts before and her own kind of resulted in this award recently received. So we're very happy with the art teaching that the school district has provided. We're sad, very saddened to hear that we'll be losing some of her talent. We understand we're also gaining an excellent teacher to replace her, but we think that splitting that role between two teachers does cause a loss of continuity and management that we think will have an impact on arts at Westlake. As things do change, you are able to factor in various concerns or comments. We would like to see Julie Nolkeview regain that 100% appointment at Westlake. She's an excellent teacher. We don't want to share her with anybody else. Thank you.
What I'd like to say is that it was really hard for us to hear this because we know that the arts in the elementary school are just as important as the arts in the secondary school. And what's hard is that we just couldn't wrap our head around the fact that the administrators probably didn't know what we were doing. Elementary art is completely different. You ask any art expert than secondary art. Santa Cruz High School jewelry department started in the 1980s with an empty room. My friend Loretta Razzo and I went to Los Angeles. Her jewelry department in her high school was being demolished and let go. We thought it was horrible. So we took our van down to LA. We loaded it up. That teacher gave us all those jewelry supplies, slides, everything. We went into the metal shop at Santa Cruz High, it was used for storage. We built that program. We designed and built that program from scratch. Over the years, since the 80s, parents have donated, appreciated, commended us for our program, which is the only one in this county. That lab over there, and I want you to know that it's a lab. It's about a $20,000 lab that's been completely bought and paid for by the people of this city. I teach parents who have their kids at Santa Cruz High now that want to take those jewelry classes. By cutting that lab, you're slapping these people in the face that have given over the years, over and over again, and have trusted that we were going to continue with this wonderful jewelry program, which we are the only one in Santa Cruz County. I have students coming from Los Gatos High School, Watsonville High, to take these art classes. If you ask anybody, that's why we get high enrollment. We have a problem with attrition? Well, you start cutting any of the arts, and people will leave. I even had parents go, that's where I was going to bring my kid over to Santa Cruz High because of the arts. So I don't want to be sarcastic, but I want you to know that this program is a serious program. It's a serious lab. It's cost thousands of dollars to create. We're down to one jewelry class now. We had a full-time jewelry class at one point. One was cut when Lindsay was hired because she wanted to teach. She had to teach leadership. She did it for 5 years from the bottom of her heart. She worked really, really hard to get that through. And then she was penalized again after she said she could no longer do it via a doctor's order. She had to stop. It was too stressful. Anybody that's ever taught leadership is really stressful. But she did it because she was a young teacher. And she cut back. And we were willing to say, okay, if they did one jewelry class away from us, I guess they can have you teach leadership instead. She taught leadership and jewelry at the same time. Who does that? You don't ask a science teacher to do that. So what I'm saying, for something that is as valuable as the arts in this community, which it is, it's paramount. Why would you even think about, or please please consider, highly consider, the ramifications of these programs. We are self-sustaining. We are not a CTE class that's coming around the bend that's going to cost the district lots of money. And I know we have that whole deal going on, but you have to understand that those labs that ROP paid for are going to start crashing. You get 5 years of computer use with students and then it's done. Who's going to pay for those labs? The ceramics lab, the drawing and painting studio, the jewelry studio at Santa Cruz High are all paid for and self-sustaining. So it's not a really good business decision, as far as I'm concerned. So please consider these ramifications, not only with the kids, but with the public. 30, 40 years of people giving to these programs, and jewelry department, jewelry design is not frivolous. This is a serious, it's a 4-year degree, and then some. Everybody in here wears jewelry. You don't know what it costs. So just realize this is a serious, it's a serious world. And so what we try to get the kids doing is completely learning this stuff. And Lindsay now is going to get her CTE credential.
Katie.
Ira's going to get a CTE credential. And hopefully we can compete with some of these classes that are kind of wiggling us out, which we feel is going on. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate everything you guys do. Thank you.
Want to clarify a few things. Our arts programs are incredible. They are. K-12, we have amazing arts programs. And I've worked at Santa Cruz High and know about the amazing art that comes from the programs there. At the elementary level, there is no reduction in art instruction at Westlake. It's becoming a shared position. It was previously, and it's becoming a shared position again. But it's still a 1.0. There's no reduction. Measure P does pay for that art, those art sections, and this does not show any reduction there. At Santa Cruz High School, it's a 0.17 reduction in art, and the teacher had also been teaching a leadership class, so that is what the credential area reduction came from, so it's actually one semester, which is the equivalent of a year of an art section at Santa Cruz High. The teacher before that had been before the previously also had been part-time taught health and jewelry, so it had been a shared position before. We are experiencing declining enrollment in our high schools, and so the reductions in sections weren't only in art at Santa Cruz High, they were in other areas too. We saw reductions in sections at our other schools. It just happened to be that this wasn't an area where through leaves or retirements or other things that was able to absorb that reductions. And we were fortunate that across the district we were able to absorb reductions at other sites based on that. The arts programs that Measure O pays for are the after-school art programs in the middle schools and the stipends for the high school programs. So that it's not a reduction in what we said Measure O would pay for. It is Measure O is covering everything we said Measure O would cover. So I just wanted to clarify those things.
Board discussion. Does anybody have any comments? Go ahead, Jeremy.
I've got a bunch of questions. I'll just start with the first and then I'll let other people talk. So I'm hearing from people in the audience that it's a 0.33 reduction in art. And I'm hearing from you that it's half of that. It's a 0.17, so I need clarification on that.
So the Santa Cruz High will see a 0.17 reduction in art. The particular credential, when you do reduction by credential area, and because this, like I said before, this position used to be a health and art position, and it changed then to a leadership and art position. And so this was a reduction in a leadership reduction and a one section of art reduction that then resulted in a credential movement and a seniority placement based on.
So instead of one teacher teaching 6 art classes, that teacher would teach 5 or mm-hmm. during the course of the year. Got it. Mm-hmm. Point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Is that it, Jeremy?
No. Are there any other?
There's no other.
Oh.
I have a question.
is it our policy, should, as Mr. Christian is hopeful for, and I am too, as our, we have excellent schools, excellent upper divisions, my student went through, should our enrollment increase? Do we go back to what we had last removed as policy? Meaning that should we lose this 1.7 in art and find that we've had enrollment jumps, would the class come back? Is that policy to take what's last? Or because you've had reductions across the board, how does that happen?
So there's been reductions in more than one area. So what we have to do, hopefully we will have higher enrollment. That would be great. We can add additional FTE back to the site. And in that case, what the school site would have to look at is what are the master schedule needs of the students that have are in Moeling. So where are we seeing overages in classes? So we'd analyze, where are we seeing overages? Where do we need to add the FTE? Okay.
Jeremy?
So Patty's leading me into, that's a good segue for my next question, and that is that this 1.17% reduction in art, is that roughly equivalent to the reduction we're seeing in Santa Cruz High School in English and social science and language and physical education?
So if you'll recall, when we bought that first list,
Yes, there
were a lot of different credential areas where we were seeing reductions, and those were from across the board. I don't have a list of every single class that they saw reductions in, but they did have a reduction of FTE. Do you remember exactly how much FTE Santa Cruz High reduced by?
I don't recall at this point.
Got it.
We could get that information to you.
Do you have more questions?
Yes.
Nobody else is competing for the floor, just keep going.
And then just to clarify, we're projecting an enrollment loss in Santa Cruz High School. What is our number? How many fewer students are we looking at perhaps next year than this year? What percentage does that represent?
So I don't have that information with me tonight, but I can get it to you. And I can get you the total FTE reduction based on that allocation.
Yeah, I guess where I'm going with this, I think it should be obvious, is that as sad as this is, if in fact English has taken a roughly equivalent hit and social science has taken a roughly equivalent hit and physical education and language arts and so on have taken roughly equivalent hits, because and these are somewhat parallel, although I know that scheduling is not, it's a imperfect science, then I understand this rather than if art had been signaled out for this 1.17, but I'm assuming that is obviously not the case. I think those are
that
my
is
questions.
Correct.
Thank you.
Do we have a motion?
Can I? I was waiting.
Oh,
for
sorry, Sheila. Go ahead. We were on board discussion.
Oh, okay. I thought it was questions. I think I just, I feel, I know of both our teachers and the high quality of work they've done. And I think all of us here highly value it. I think we all wish that enrollment wasn't going down in a way that meant we had to cut back on programs in our high schools. And I think I particularly wish it for this. So I know there's a kind of a hollow feeling to saying we wish we didn't have to do this, but we do. The one thing I want to correct and something that people said was the parcel taxes do not pay the full weight of the things we want to have for the school, and the state does not pay the full weight of running this district. So between the two, we do our very best with the parcel tax, and we have a committee that oversees it to use the money as we say we will use it. And that does not mean we can save everything. But it does not mean we don't value it. We do. And I've been through this. I started working at Santa Cruz City Schools in 1972. I was gone for a long period in the middle, but I've been through this before, and it is always heartbreaking, and it's heartbreaking here at this table with these administrators. And if we can, I think that we would all love to be able to bring this back. We've heard from a lot of people, and I think we would all love to bring it back. But we can't do what the state won't do for us, and we can't do with the parcel taxes everything we want to do. So my heart goes out to those two teachers who I know run really good programs. But I think we're doing what we have to do right now. Thanks.
Jeremy?
So Rainey and Katie have raised one other issue that I'm unclear about and would like clarification of. Is this the only jewelry section offered that's being cut? And by cutting this, are we leaving a program that has that people have put so much sweat equity and dollars into empty? Because that would be... Will there be at least some sections of jewelry?
Well, 0.66 jewelry at Santa Cruz High School.
So we'll have one section for one semester.
0.33.
Right?
Is it 0.33
jewelry. So two jewelries, two photo.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I had that wrong.
Okay, so it's not as if the room would be abandoned and the stuff will go to the four corners. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's some solid so far. Thank you.
Do we have a motion?
Move to approve.
Second.
Sheila.
Student recommendation. Roll call.
No.
Oh, isn't it? It's a resolution.
Oh, right, you're right.
It's a resolution.
It's a resolution.
Aye.
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 And I'm sorry, what was the straight approval?
No.
No. Okay, 8.3.2, Angela, English Learner Report.
Okay, I'm going to be bringing to you tonight our annual report of the progress of our English learners. And what I'd like to do is share with you briefly the assessment that we use. It's a consistent assessment, what it measures. And then I'm going to show you a series of slides, and they have one thing in common, which is, I'm just going to preview for you now, it doesn't look good. When we're looking at our English learner progress, we're going to see the ways in which we are, our students are not progressing at the rate that the state is recommended. So the last piece of this report is more hopeful. We have a group of teachers and administrators who are working together to really truly address not the test results, but the foundational, what we believe is the foundational problem that we can address within schools. So let's start off with, and I always do this wrong. So our English learners, we have 867 English learners in our district, and there are many different ways to assess their progress, but we have one consistent tool, which is the California English Language Development Test, and that's given every fall to all students whose first language is other than English who have not reclassified. And the assessment measures students' progress in two ways. The first is the annual measurable achievement objective, one, which is measuring, are they making a year's worth of progress every year? So it's a really important tool for us to determine wherever they start, are they making the progress that we expect each year? But the second one is even more important because that's the measurement of, are they achieving the proficiency that would put them on par with an English-only student? So AMAO2 is that measurement of, have they reached proficiency in listening, speaking, reading, and writing? And since 2009, we've looked at it two different ways. We've looked at the cohort of students who have been in U.S. schools fewer than 5 years, and the cohort who've been in school for 5 or more years. We break it down in this way because we know that we have students, the majority of students in our district, who were born here and spoke Spanish with their family, but have been in our schools since kindergarten. And we know from Dr. Kenji Hakuda's research that by 6th or 7th grade, those students should be on par with their EO peers. And so that second cohort, the students who have been in our schools 5 years or more, is the one that we watch really carefully. Because if we're doing what we say that we're doing, then they should be right there. Now, those of you who have 6th and 7th graders or have lived with them, you know that the level of English proficiency for many of them is still not very high. So we continue to need to provide English instruction. Huh? However, we want them to be on par at that point. The group that's in the first and the less than 5 years oftentimes are our newcomer students. So particularly when we look at our secondary, fewer than 5 year students, some of them are not only coming here within the last few years, they may not have had consistent education in their home country. So here we go with our charts. In the first one, we're looking at the red line is the target. And so the state sets for us a target that gradually increases over time. And what you're going to note is that there were periods where we exceeded the target, but in the last 2 years, we are not meeting that target. In fact, there was a pretty rapid drop-off between 14-15 and 15-16. And what this shows us is that overall, in our secondary district, English learners are not making a year's progress at the pace that the state would like and at the pace that we would like. So our students who have been here fewer than 5 years, again, the target is the red line, and the blue line shows that it's pretty erratic. One of the factors that contributes to this line kind of going up and down is this is a really small cohort. This might be between 20 to 40 students. So a shift in that cohort or an influx of students who are coming, who haven't had a great deal of schooling, who may be transitioning in a kind of dramatic way to a new school, that can all impact their self-test. With the proficient in 5 or more years, again, this is the group that most concerns us because this is the group that we believe should be reaching proficiency. And again, we're seeing kind of a sharp drop-off in the last year. In our elementary district, it's a little more consistent, and with elementary self-scores, we tend to see more consistency in general. Our students are coming in and making that annual progress up through intermediate level. They tend to plateau there. They tend to not make a lot of progress after that. But the elementary progress, there's fewer gaps between where the state would like us to be and where we see our students. In fewer than 5 years, well, most of our elementary school students have been here fewer than 5 years. So this is the opposite of the secondary. The majority of English learners are in this group. Again, dipped in 14-15, but we saw an increase in 15-16. So this is one place where we have something to celebrate. And then proficient in 5 or more years, a drop here as well. So when I look at this data, what I see is that back in 09-10, we had some places where we were meeting the state criteria, but we haven't seen that steady progress over time. This is concerning. What we've addressed as a district team is initially, is it our curriculum? Do we need to adopt a new standardized curriculum that more closely aligns with our language development standards? And about 4 years ago, we went to systematic ELD in elementary. We trained our teachers. We had coaching and support for that. And while I believe that our teachers are faithfully following this, what we know about language development is that it really can't be contained to 40 minutes a day, that it can't be contained to lockstep lessons, that it goes beyond that particular point in time, and that it's best taught through content instruction. And so on April 25th, we took 18 of our teachers and administrators to a launch in Santa Clara. And the purpose of this launch was to look at an ELA-ELD framework. What's exciting about this is it moves us beyond this 45-minute-a-day ELD in isolation to teaching language as it's meant to be taught throughout the day, away from having an ELD teacher who is the only one charged with this task, to all of our teachers are teaching language development. All of our teachers are charged with not only teaching science and math and writing and history, but teaching language through that content. And this may seem like something new for California. It's not new for Santa Cruz State Schools. We've already had many of our teachers have piloted those units. Many of our teachers have been pushing us. Some of them are in the audience right now. And they've been saying, you know, these boxes and these sets, they're great, they're glossy, and they're very tidy. But that is not how language is developed. We need to do this in a more integrated fashion. We took a team on April 25th. We followed up immediately. We had two additional meetings, the May 2nd and May 9th. And this team was really excited about moving forward with expanding language development beyond that block. We have a couple of schools that are interested in piloting, kind of taking charge, and we have some schools and some great students that think maybe next year with the math adoption they might, you know, not charge ahead immediately. But our focus moving forward is not only to provide the training that you see, but to really implement and launch a framework that teaches language as it should be taught. And I was sharing with Erin, we were looking at these numbers together. We were talking about, for those of you who've learned Spanish as a second language, that it really doesn't happen in that 90 minutes with a teacher once a day. So it doesn't make sense that we expect that our English learners will get that full level of proficiency through this block. So I'm spending less time with the data now that we have more of a focus on our next step, but we'll continue to monitor our English learners both through the SELP. We also monitor them through their performance on the CAS, on the standardized test. We monitor their work on their writing. But what I'm really hoping our next step is as a district is that our English learner progress is embraced by the entire school community, and that we're monitoring their progress not just once a year through the SELP, but in an ongoing way.
Questions from the board? Dee Dee?
This is incredibly disheartening, incredibly, but hopeful as moving forward. My question has to do with the differences between language development in the elementary years and language development at secondary level. It seems to me that they're very different needs, and I'm wondering how moving forward in trying to address these disheartening data, how we're going to differentiate the kind of curriculum that we're going to offer at the elementary level versus the secondary.
This is one where I think moving away from a text to looking at the standards. So the new ELD standards are very connected to an ELA-ELD framework. Moving away from kind of that bricks and mortar, learning prepositions, learning grammar in isolation, to learning language in a really dynamic environment. So the new ELD standards are very aligned with Common Core ELA. In the secondary level, students are asked to and given the tools to reason, to explain their reasoning. It's very different from the ELD when I began teaching, which was even in high school, still fill in the blank, here's your sentence, skim, complete the sentence. It really is focused on language expression, on the ability to be persuasive, on the ability to argue. So it's looking at ELD as a framework not just for those basic kind of communication skills, but the ability to reason, to explain, to defend, just as we would do in Common Core. And that, I would say, extends to elementary as well. It's early on. So we're acknowledging the needs of vocabulary, we're acknowledging the needs of grammar, but we're not holding back from the expressiveness, from the reasoning. Yeah.
Jeremy?
It really helped me to disaggregate the data when we were looking at math, but we don't have that here. So, for example, we can be disappointed district-wide, but if you were to have disaggregated the data, do we have some bright spots that we can look at a la math in terms of best practices? For example, third grade at Bayview is just ripping it up, or sixth grade at B40, or ninth grade at Santa Cruz High School, that sort of thing. Without looking at it site by site, and again, not to point fingers at any particular teacher or groups of teachers, how do we know where we're really shining? And if we can find those areas, then that will inform what we want to do in the future, because those can become, if we think, best practices. So I guess I don't have that data. I didn't put it together. I'm wondering if you see any, you know, looking at it from a positive, are there any particular sites or grade levels where you say, oh, yeah, from 2009 all the way through 2016, we see...
You know, I did want to look at that as well.
And, yeah.
On this sheet, I highlighted in green the years where we saw some progress, and I didn't see a lot there. I do have it by site, and I was looking for a steady trend, and I didn't see a steady trend. So I do have a couple of schools and a couple of years where the data looks better, but I didn't see a steady one site over 3 years. There was an increase, but I'd be happy to share this with you.
If you think that there's places to look at where we can say, okay, these particular teachers at this particular site have really got this going on, you know?
Yeah. One of the places, though, I think I'd like to bring back, because this is just the state, this is the SELP test.
Right.
We have seen in our Walk to Be program in elementary, we have seen tremendous growth with our English learners. So in our local assessments, our SRI, which is empirical data, we have seen tremendous growth in the cohorts there. We've seen that across the board. So I would say we're doing well in terms of reading comprehension, in terms of inference. The self-test tends to be broader than that. And I think even to break it down more, we probably could look at where is it within the self that our students are struggling. And I think we would guess that it would be in writing, which is typically the area that comes along a little bit later. So there are bright spots, and I would say we don't use the SELP as a progress monitoring in the same way that we use the SRI. The SRI is 3 years in or 3 times a year in elementary, so we can use that data in real time and make adjustments and support. But the SELP is more like the overall health of our program. And so when Dee Dee points out this is depressing, it is depressing. We want to see gains for our entire district overall.
Is it safe to say then that one area we could look at carefully would be lighting?
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sheila. Okay, I have two questions. I'm just going to do one right now. I haven't heard you say, but I can't imagine you haven't looked at it this way. Why aren't we looking, or are we looking at why it dropped in the last year? Because it seems like we're talking about, let's try something new, bigger, you know, but it dropped in the last year. So what is that about? Have we looked at that? Like, what has changed, perhaps, or not changed?
So I looked first at elementary, which has the most consistent curriculum, to see, you know, do we have turnover, do we have changes in the implementation. We had one coach in 14-15 who was serving across the district. And before that, we had an Ealer who was more focused on the elementary implementation. So it could be that it was an implementation gap where we had new teachers coming in. We didn't have enough coaching support. This year, we have two coaches. One is dedicated to elementary and the other to secondary. And I think, again, the model that we currently have is the ELD teacher is really, there isn't a lot of time given for ELD teachers to share their practice. So it's kind of like you're on your own with your thoughts. So that's one possibility, is that last year there wasn't the coaching support that we had the years before when Belinda was able to go and help people set up their lessons and talk them through. And that's about as far as I've gotten in terms of what could that drop have been.
Could there also have been a change in the self that was dramatic?
The self stayed pretty consistent. We will have a new assessment, the LPAC, and that initially was coming 16-17, and it's been delayed another year. The frustrating thing about the SELP is that it's a consistent tool, but it's not aligned with our English language development standards. So, again, it's consistent. It shows us our progress. We're obviously looking at other measures in terms of determining how our students are doing. But I don't want to, in any way deflate its importance. It's a consistent tool that we should be making more progress.
Dee Dee?
So moving forward, given the merging between ELD and ELA and Common Core, I'm just trying to figure this out. What you just said about the SELT, are we going to move from the SELT to the LPAC?
We will.
As an assessment measure.
Yeah. Okay. And the LPAC will be given twice a year. So the LPAC will be given in the fall and then in the spring. So it will give us better data as well.
So in the fall and the spring. And so it doesn't have the advantage of the SRI where you can make adjustments in pedagogy and curriculum. Okay.
We'll still need the SRI.
Yeah.
Sheila, did you ask your second question?
Oh no.
This is your second question.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I cheated, but yeah. They fit together. So, I also don't want to in any way diminish this because this is disturbing. But knowing what I know about children and learning and development, and knowing what we all know about the dangers of relying too much on tests, I'm struck by you saying that since Walk to Read went in, we've seen growth, great growth. And from the point of view of my psychologist self and my cognitive self, I would say that growth is probably the most important thing in many ways. So to me, am I right to think that in some ways the question is, why isn't that translating into this broader measure? Because if I were going to trust what I was seeing when I saw Walk to Read and the kids' development, I would trust that that was what was going to lead to cognitive development. And the one area I think that's probably not true of is writing. But I don't know how to ask a question, really, but I'm just wondering your thoughts about it, because it seems to me like it's like when I keep hearing we have to say how many kids are proficient. We all know that not all kids get proficient at certain things before they graduate from high school, and guess what? That's normal. I mean, it is normal. The problem is what's happening with our English language learners is not good enough. It's not normal. So I don't want to diminish it, but I'm wondering about, are we having more growth than we're able to measure for a reason?
Right. So I think it's two questions in one, or at least that's how I'm hearing it. The first is around, how do we use this SELT and why do we use this SELT if we have some great measures locally that we can use? And the state does leave it up to each district to determine what their reclassification criteria is. So that's the criteria where we say you are proficient, you are now at the same level of it as an English-only student. They give us that freedom to set that. However, one of the criteria that's set by the state is mastery on the SELT. So we do need to pay attention to the SELT, even though it's only once a year. It's not connected to the English language development standards. It's a key part of our progress monitoring. But the second piece of what you're saying is the acknowledgement of progress over proficiency. And we do want to see progress, knowing that students maybe reach proficiency a bit later. What we're not seeing is that consistent progress. And for our English learner, I think the stakes are even more high, because it may take you longer in some other areas to reach proficiency, but we need all of our students to be competent with reading, writing, speaking, and listening, if that's the access that they need to college and career. So I think the stakes are a little bit higher there, and that's why, even though the SELP may just be that once-a-year monitoring tool, we're paying really close attention to our English learners in the other areas.
And I just want to comment, clarify that I agree with all of that, but I also am constantly concerned about the ways in which our thinking about what works and what we see right in front of us has changed in such a way that we may be on to exactly that, which would be the solution in terms of how the walk to read is working. And I don't want to miss it, because I feel like a lot of that has happened over the last 15, 20 years with the testing craze, is that we have ignored that which is right in front of us that works in terms of child development and learning. And so to me, it's a, I want to see our ELL kids going up, but I also want to make sure that we're looking with clear eyes at what we're doing. Does that make sense?
Jeremy?
I mean, this district has been through a lot of iterations around this sort of stuff, and in the ideal world, what we see, what a teacher sees in his or her classroom, and what the tests that we administer reveal would be reflected by state-administered once-a-year tests. And what we have done, at least in my limited experience in the past, is when those state-administered tests don't, when there's a discrepancy, we kind of poo-poo it and say, well, we see that the kids are doing really well. And I'm really happy that, not about these scores, but that you're upfront about the fact that we need to do better. Because after all, there's no magic to these tests. It's reading and writing and listening and speaking, et cetera. No, et cetera. And so I really applaud your honesty about it, and I can only hope that if we're on to good things here in terms of our walk to read and other programs, at some point our kids just soar on these tests. But I take them very seriously, and I think they're valid. So thanks.
Dee Dee?
One last question. I'll stop bothering you. I'm just looking at the next steps that you're suggesting, and I know our teachers work incredibly hard with our ELL students and are doing some really wonderful things. Looking at these next steps, you've got curriculum instruction with the ELA, ELD integration, right? And then you have some training for teachers around the English learner proficiency profile. Can you give me a sense of more specifically how we're going to support our teachers as we're shifting towards this more integrated curriculum?
So the English learner proficiency profile is the tool that we can use to support teacher awareness and understanding of the new standards. So it's a rubric that breaks those standards down along a continuum. And I'm thinking back probably more than 20 years ago when we were looking at writing through that same way of, you know, what is writing really entail? And what does language really entail? It needs to be broken down. We need to acknowledge the different stages. And that's what this English learner proficiency profile does. What we've learned is that we've had an elementary team working with it this year, that for teachers to understand the standards that they need to support, they need to interact with that profile and with their student work. So that training, what that training has looked like this year, we've had a small group of teachers who have met monthly. They've brought student writing, they've brought examples of student work, and they've lined it up with the English learner profile. And they've been able to annotate it so that that tool can then be used not just for assessment purposes, but really for teacher training so that they know when we're talking about the standard, what does this look like? And if we want students to be proficient, what does a proficient writing sample look like? So that's the first level of training, is really awareness of the standards, breaking that down into chunks, and giving teachers an opportunity to reflect on their student progress as well as their own practice. That's the start.
Can I also just add to that that our coaches are working collaboratively? Our science coaches are working with our ELD coaches as the elementary team is planning for the implementation of the new math adoption. They're talking about integrating ELD into that training with the, at the same time. So there's going to be lots of layers of this work, and it's going to be over time.
Are there comments from the public?
Mr. Stanley Price wants to speak once again.
Hello. Casey Carlson, not representing the Federation. I'm speaking as a resource specialist, an observant resource specialist. And I know it's late, but this is an issue that has troubled me for many, many years. And I actually just shared my concerns with Chris and Molly last week, but I feel like I need to share them with the board. So, what I'm about to say doesn't apply to the newcomer class because I believe that needs to be a separate program. But I really support what Angela's saying about not having these classes be isolated. So in special ed, all my career as being a special educator, we've been trying to move kids out of special ed classes and integrate them because we know they learn better in an integrated environment. And so it's always really confused me why our ELL learners, after they pass the newcomer level, are segregated in a class that does not teach the same curriculum as the other English 9 and English 10 classes. And then those students are expected to go to English 10 or 11 or 12 and perform at grade level standards after they were in a segregated class that was very often taught by the newest teacher or the least experienced teacher, or in some cases a teacher that doesn't have an English credential because the law allows them to teach out of subject one period. And I don't want to be too specific in public because I don't want those, it's not those teachers' fault that they might get assigned to teach that class. But they're not able, they don't have the depth and breadth of experience to teach the English curriculum. And I'm not surprised that the writing shows up low, because even when the reading might be addressed, those kids are not getting writing assignments. They're not writing 5-paragraph essays. They don't learn how to write persuasive essays. They're not doing research papers. And then they're supposed to go to the next level, and they're not prepared, and they get discouraged, and they get low grades. Now, if they're in my program, they've got us to back them up. But the kids who are ELL learners and not in special ed, I see those kids foundering. So I think segregation is never going to work. They're not being prepared. They need to have high-level teachers. And a couple of times at Soquel, it just happened that teachers who had simultaneously been Humanities Academy teachers, or I can think of a teacher as an honors level teacher, they got assigned to the ELL class, and they taught it with the same curriculum that they were teaching to their English 9 class. They scaffolded. They might have shortened the assignment or broke it down into more steps, but the kids read the same material. They were exposed to the same standards, and so they were ready to move on and be successful. But until we end that segregation and assigning teachers who are less able, less qualified to do that teaching, I'm not surprised at all that we didn't see progress in the secondary level, and it's something that's really upset me for all my years. And again, I can do something about it in terms of my students because they have IEPs, so sometimes I'll double enroll them, like an English 9 and an ELL support class, because I know they need to be exposed to that curriculum, but that has to change for all of our ELL learners.
Thank you.
we'll come back to the board after public comment.
Almost all of my administrative experience has been in predominantly Hispanic schools and communities. 90-100% Hispanic and so forth. And I would just like to say that I am certainly more than impressed with the honesty that this particular administration has brought to this very difficult subject. This is not an easy thing to overcome. I want you to know that the school district, on other forms of the settlement in the past, especially over at Bayview School, when Dan Kavanaugh was the principal of the unheard of test scores, I want you to know that you have my full confidence that you're going to find ways to increase the achievement test scores of our students. And as a full-time student of Spanish myself, I know that you don't get it in 45-minute little sections. You have to work on it all the time. And I applaud what you're attempting to do. And I'm most confident that this particular school district is going to show us the way to do it. So I'm looking forward to hearing this report next year. And thank you so much for listening. Thank you again.
This isn't an action item, and we still have two more reports. If there are questions that can be delayed, but if not, let me know, and we'll keep going. Sheila?
I'm going to delay most of my question, but I have to say that what Casey said rings so true to me that I hope we can look into it.
Thank you, Angela. And now it's Angela. It's the Angela show. Yay.
I think part of the why we feel comfortable being honest is that we do have an amazingly strong and committed teaching community, parent community, and student community. And I think putting the information out there is not being done in a way to in any way castigate or point fingers. It's to say, here's our problem. Let's figure this out together. And we say that with confidence that we're gonna arrive at the solution. So I'm bringing to you a very different report. This is just a preview of some of the revisions that will be coming your way. We are in year four of our LCAP, and I'll be bringing back to you in June for public hearing the revisions to the local control and accountability plan. The life cycle, so the LCAP is an ongoing process, and we are at the point in our process where we have reviewed stakeholder input. We have brought forward some recommendations. We've reviewed those recommendations with stakeholders. We are awaiting the governor and the May revision to find out what the budget really is at this point in time. And I'm learning to say at this point in time from my friend because it does shift sometimes day to day. I wanted to preview with you tonight a few of those recommendations that have come forward. Most of what we were hearing from stakeholders is that what we have in place, the walk-to-read coordinators, the learning assistants in elementary, the full-time counselors, that's all going well. We're in the process of gathering the data to show that, looking at attendance data, looking at suspension, expulsion. We're also looking at our student performance. But there were a few revisions that are coming through. The first one is really connected to the need to support our staff with professional development and the Common Core standards, and along with that, to provide materials for math intervention and software in particular, so that teachers can set up smaller groups and acknowledge that very targeted need that some of our students have. We are looking to increase our positive behavior intervention and support, and our elementary principal team would like to recommend that we have a coach position who could serve all four of the schools. That coach would connect our schools with resources in Santa Clara, would help the schools with monitoring their progress and monitoring the culture and climate at that school. And we're building strong PBIS programs in each of the schools, And this work can't be done in an isolated manner. We really need that support of a central position to help bring it all together. We're always looking to bring in additional curriculum and assessment materials, but again with LCFF to target those to our student subgroups. And the last revision is one that we didn't have last year, and I'm excited to bring this forward, and that is to really recognize the importance of supporting our parents and doing that through childcare, through food, through translation, and so we're building that into the budget as well, making sure that parent meetings have all of those amenities so that we can see more of our parents, especially parents who are coming straight from work. In our secondary, we are adding in a position that has been funded through Common Core funding, bringing it back. It's a 0.2 Common Core ELA coach at our middle schools, both of our middle schools, and this position has been really instrumental in supporting the shift to Common Core writing. we're increasing an avid class at Harbor. We're going to go up to 5 avid classes, and with that comes increased cost for tutoring. And I'm sorry, I neglected to point out in the previous slide, these are revisions that were recommended by these stakeholder groups. So parents, staff, and leadership all brought that one forward. And most of our recommendations are coming from 3 or more of the stakeholder groups. Our secondary schools also have recommended that we increase the number of Chromebooks and carts. That came from our secondary parents, our staff, leadership, and students. And in keeping with our RTI model, adding a 0.2 or a 1 position of Math Plus at each of our high schools. And this position, this class would be an intervention period with flexible entrance and exits. So students would be assigned to that class, they would earn credit, but they would also be exited from the class when they've met their goals. So it's a model that we've seen in the middle schools, and we're happy to bring it forward to high school. We know that double blocking can be hard and doesn't reflect that framework of acknowledging student needs and then acknowledging when they no longer need the program.
I was just going to add that these are, just because we talked earlier about reducing FTE, these dollars for the stuff are about looking at our supplemental resources again, the supplemental resources that are targeting services to our English learners, our foster youth, our homeless students, and our low-income students. So I just wanted to reiterate that as we're talking about, we have different pots of funds that have different purposes, and wanted to just make sure that was clear.
Thank you. And we do have tremendous need. One of the things I brought to our district advisory committee on Monday is an overview of the different funding sources and the ways that we're trying to meet all of the needs. The last two are again, really about how do we better connect our parents with school. And so, again, providing resources to support parent participation at a DLAC meeting in January, where we specifically wanted to get more participation on the survey. We let them know ahead of time that we had food, we had childcare, we of course had translation. We also had additional staff on hand to help parents with writing their responses, and our turnout tripled that night. So I think any time that we can really be thoughtful about what helps folks make that transition from work to school to evening meetings, we're going to see a greater participation rate. Our last recommendation coming from staff, leadership, and parents is to add a 0.5 school community coordinator at each school site. Currently, our middle schools have a part-time community coordinator, and Harbor has a part-time. We see those positions as providing tremendous resource, both for students and their families. This is a position that often works with families outside of the school day, helping connect them to not only the school resources, but can also help connect them now to our social workers and the resources that they will provide. Typically, our community coordinators are bilingual, so they are working with families in their first language. And again, this is all, if we're fully funded at the May revise, we'll find out next week. These are some of the recommendations coming forward. So our next steps in the process, we are I'm working on the draft. The county office has offered to read through the draft of what we have so far. And I'll be making revisions per their guidance. I'll be bringing back to you on June 15th the LCAP for a public hearing, and then we'll come back on the 22nd for, hopefully, for approval.
Jeremy.
Quick question.
We have a renegade light. Thank you, Dr. Larson.
If you do without your light.
I guess I can't ask questions. Thank you, sir.
Apologize.
Jeremy. Yes. How creative can we be with this as we move to a more interdisciplinary approach? I don't see music or art in the LCAP budget. And yet we know that we have gifted music and art teachers in the district, and that this group of students that qualifies for these specific funds will enjoy these sorts of programs as much as any other group. And in fact, art and music can be seen as universal languages. I'm thinking, I don't think it's thinking too much outside the box to say that, was there any thought We're reducing an art program by .166666. And we rounded up to .17. Was there any thought to taking that .17 and saying to that art teacher, you know, these kids could really benefit from a jewelry class as long as there's some writing and such incorporated into it? I'm thinking broadly about it. Is that kosher? Is that something that can be done? After all, creative thinking and working and analysis can be done through all sorts of venues. Have you given any thought to that?
So,
thank you for bearing with me.
I'm thinking. So our LCAP charges us with increasing student outcomes,
yes,
and student engagement.
Yes.
And student outcomes is really, we're looking at a couple of things. We're looking at, you know, their test scores, their proficiency. Student engagement, we're looking at, do they come to school? Do they feel comfortable in school? And I think what you're touching on is really our responsibility to see the whole child and to address what are the barriers. And if we were to, and we survey students, we could survey them more, or we can survey them less. We survey students a lot. One thing we've learned is we survey them all the time. We need to kind of come up with a plan for that. One way that this could come out is we could learn that students are not feeling, students don't have access to the arts, that we're not creating a system where they can have access to their academics and the arts. And so that's one way where we may say we're going to create a course that is outside of the school day that allows students to have more access to the arts. But it's a data-driven plan in a couple of ways. It's data-driven both through the outcome data and also through the survey data. And I'll tell you, students weighed in heavily on the importance of intramural sports and activities, and that's something that Harvard's looking at and I think other schools are looking at. They also wanted to see more technology, but I think, you know, absolutely, we could be looking at what is getting in the way and what within the LCAP could increase student engagement.
Didi.
I have a two-parter. Given the four categories that we have for the LCAP funds, how much overlap is there between these categories, and what is the group that we have the highest percentage of students?
Our highest percentage of students is our low-income students. Is that the unduplicated? Yes.
Okay, and how much overlap is there between low-income and low?
Last year it was about 80% of our 70%, I think. It's a little bit lower. I need to check.
Okay,
I'm sorry. Okay. That's an important piece to know. So just, we're monitoring the progress of English learners, low-income foster youth, but our English learners and our low-income students are counted once. So that's important to note. Mm-hmm. I'll get back to you.
Okay, so the second part of that, given those statistics, is how are these recommendations going to serve that larger population of low-income students, for example?
Right. So we, along with the recommendations are aligned with our goals, and most of these recommendations are aligned with goals 5 and 6 in the LCAP, which are that they're, and those goals are aligned with goal 3. So they're about closing the achievement gap. So we're setting goals within the LCAP for steady progress towards closing the achievement gap. So, for example, with the Math Plus, we're monitoring student performance in two ways. The number of students who take and pass Algebra 1, next year it will be Math 1, and are successful the first time. And then we're also measuring on the CAS in 3rd through 8th grade, and then in 11th grade in high school. So we're measuring a couple of different ways.
So you disaggregate that data to look at
for each of the subgroups.
Okay.
Sheila. Every once in a while, I just go back to a basic question that makes me wonder where my brain has been. Can you talk to me a little bit about the overlap between Title I and supplemental dollars?
Yes. And it's difficult because they serve very similar purposes. So our Title I funds are allocated to students who are living in poverty and not performing at the level of proficiency. Our LCFF supplemental dollars are also targeted towards low-income students and students studying English as their second language in foster youth. We give LCFF supplemental to all of our schools based on the number of students that they have that meet those categories. We also have Title I funds that go to all of our schools that meet a level of students who are at that. So, for example, if a school has 37% or more students living in poverty, then they receive Title I funds. Those funds are very similar in terms of their purpose. And so oftentimes what we'll see, for example, in elementary in the Walk to Read program, a principal can use Title I funds and LCFF supplemental to support a Walk to Read program and then measure the progress through the same lens. How are our English learners doing? How are our students who are low income doing?
I just wanted to add that threshold changes at different times, and it was 37% this year, it's 42% next year for being qualifying as a Title I school. So all of our current schools will qualify as Title I schools, but it's putting one of them really on the edge of qualifying for being a Title I school. So that's kind of, I think Angela's hitting right on it. The difference is Title I, you have to have a threshold of a certain number of students who are low income, but with LCFF, we're able to distribute to all of the schools for their English learners, their low-income students, their homeless youth. But it's proportional to the number of students they have. Does that make sense?
So
they're not very different.
This may sound like a really stupid question, and you can just say, that's a stupid question, and I'll stop. But if you think of it as two different things, then when we make an LCFF decision, is there such a thing as someone who represents Title I who could say, wait a minute, maybe that's not the way to go, or not? Do they get melded together and LCFF now runs the show, or is there still a balance?
There's still a balance.
Okay. I'm trying to personify it so that I can get the answer.
I think what's different is LCFF is part of a new way of working with state funding that's much more transparent and much more accountable, not only to our student outcome, data, but to the process. And that's why we have District Advisory Committee, we have multiple ways of gathering information and sharing it. Title I, we're very much sharing how we've used those funds, how our students are performing, but we're not beholden to that same process of sharing with the public.
But it is shared with schools' site councils. So a Title I school is working with their site council on their plan for their Title I dollars. And we're accountable to federal audits. Mm-hmm. One, we will have one next year in our secondary district to look at the expenditures of all of our federal dollars.
Patty, I'm going to call on Jim because I think he might have some information.
Just one point to add. Thank you, President Thompson. Title I is a federal program, as Chris just alluded to, which is coming from Washington, D.C. The LCFS supplemental is coming from the state of California. So there will be overlap, one from the federal side, one from the state side. And the other piece, if I just, one quick note, addressing Member Shonet's question, is just positively, is in creating these potential programs, we have to make sure the dollars follow the students. So when you talk about supplemental, there will be a greater amount of these dollars going to students that generate them based upon the makeup of that site.
Mm-hmm. Patty.
And so with that in mind, Jim, and that clarification, can you help me get my head around when we're offering, when we have a population that has higher needs, so another class such as AVID is being offered, is it open to all students who would like to be in the, that qualify to be in the AVID program, meaning the goal of AVID is to be college prepared, to give the student the tools in order to be college prepared. Does that mean it's only offered to those that the dollars are followed, or is it open? And I'm thinking about that kind of in a broader sense to what Casey was saying in a sort of a segregation that might not be the plan whatsoever, but can happen when there are higher needs all sitting in one classroom. So, you know, I mean, I'm for full integration because I think that there's more to it than just the test scores in preparing our students for it. And so I just wanted to be clear because I think some parents have come to me with this and asked me, well, if why are we not having more input? And, you know, I encourage them to be part of the process, but also encourage them to understand that the governor's purpose was for the outcomes, these supplemental dollars to our district are, though we're no longer categorical, somewhat off, are feeling that way.
Yeah. Well, I think this AVID's a perfect example because the AVID section comes from our unit, our base budget. So it's
open.
Dollars that are, it's a section, and, you know, it's five sections now at Harvard. Yeah. We use supplemental money to make it even stronger. And we know that there's overlap given the criteria with AVID, for AVID, there's overlap. There are many students in AVID who are not only first generation, they're living in poverty, they have learned English as a second language. So we do monitor our student progress in AVID, we break that down, we look at the subgroups, and we know that it's a strong program that should be open to all students who meet that criteria.
And I wanted just to add to that, that I want to clarify that some of those sections are unit and some of those sections are Title I.
That's right. Yeah.
I think most of them are Title I. And the other thing is that we aren't allowed to identify who our low-income students are.
I know.
So the way that we identify the students in need, we look at a population at a school site and you put resources there, and the idea is you're looking at the kids who aren't proficient. So how are you using those dollars to close the achievement gap is what Angela had explained before. So we don't go through and identify all those kids who completed free and reduced lunch forms because we don't know that. That data, we don't know. That lives in Amy's office only and for her team's eyes only. That never comes into the – we just don't know. And what we do is we work to close the achievement gap using those resources.
Dee Dee?
I have a question, actually, regarding AVID. I know that all of these recommendations are going to be data-driven, and you're going to look at the outcome data after you've implemented some of these revisions. With regards to AVID, I think we hear mostly about the outcomes having to do with
the percentage of our students that end up going to either a community college or four-year. But you just said that we actually look at the disaggregated data for AVID students, and I often don't hear about the effectiveness, because AVID's not just about going to college, it's about, you know, learning skills and tutoring and supplementing the learning that's going on in all of their other subject areas. And I think to really understand the effectiveness of AVID, we need to see the broader impact.
I think that would be great to bring that back. We've been looking at, particularly our AVID students' performance in AP and honors classes, and then disaggregating that. We could bring that back.
That's a point.
Yeah.
Sheila, just really quick. I'm really happy to see the community coordinator and the other community involvement pieces in this plan. And I'm assuming we're going to get some data back in terms of how helpful that is. No question, just a comment.
Are there comments from the public?
I think that it's the right approach. For one, to have this conversation, I want to thank the district because they really listened to what the elementary principals are speaking for them, I guess. Gave us the time to present what we needed, and they listened to what we had. Sometimes it was a whole group, and if some of us were missing for whatever reason, our voices were still heard. We feel that way. And when we have the need that we see, when we have the data that is presented to us, just as for the previous presentation, we know that our teachers really need to get those levels of support when it comes to training, etc. And with these next steps that are taken, or that will be taken, we're going to have that opportunity to serve our kids that way. So thank you for that.
Okay, this isn't an action item, so we'll thank you very much, Angela, and I'll turn it over to Jim for 8.3.3.
Thank you again, President Thompson. At this time, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce our next presenter for the evening. In the last 17 months, I've been very blessed and fortunate to work with just a fantastic team, not just within the direct support of the business services, but many directors, Mr. Miller, who is on the facility side, Mr. Gomez from IT, and Ms. Amy Hedrick Farr from Food Services. And again, I just want to take my time and tip my hat to this. We had a very frank talk last week about the next journeys of life, and she was very candid in saying, you know, I really didn't know what to expect from you at the beginning, which I think was a very common thought when I came into this role. But I can truly say that the team that is, I really feel, supporting the district from all these levels is above reproach and just totally serving in their role to support the kids here of Santa Cruz. So with that, I can turn it over to Ms. Amy Hedrick Farr for our annual report on food services and dip into wellness for the district.
Thank you, Mr. Monreal. Can I get the clicker? I'll sneak over. So tonight I have a long presentation because I don't get to stand up here in front of you guys very often. So I apologize for its length, but there was lots of information and lots of things that I'm really proud of, and lots of hard work that's gone in this year from our staff and our students and our wellness team. So I'd like to share some of our achievements. Of course, we're still aligning with our district goals. This year, we've really focused on goals 2, 4, 5, and 6, focusing on student environment as well as our community partners. The other thing that we have implemented this year is professional development. Part of the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010 was that we would implement professional development for our staff. And we haven't done that in this district for quite some time, and so the staff was happy and eager and really excited. We actually just finished
a training with our leads with some hands-on training and baking, and they were very appreciative and very excited and took back lots of ideas back to their site. So these hours are required by a federal law, and they are based upon the position that you hold in the district. So some of our employees will have to perform 2 hours, some will have to do up to 8 hours. This year we've offered a total of over 140 hours of professional development opportunities for our staff, both online and hands-on. We've wrote several grants this year. I've gotten very versed at grant writing, which was new for me. In my previous district, I didn't have a lot of opportunities, so it was definitely a learning curve, and we have received several. Our largest was the Smarter Lunchroom grant of $14,000. Smarter Lunchroom is basically a concept of how to get kids to eat healthy and make healthy choices. And it's by strategic placement, it's by doing signage. They're all low-cost or no-cost solutions for us to implement. And we're really excited to do this. Actually, Santa Cruz High has already started doing some of these things this year, and we've seen great success with that. So part of this grant is we will be implementing and installing digital menu boards at Santa Cruz High and Harbor High next year in hopes to increase communication with our high school students. And, of course, we've rolled out California Thursday. I know I was up here talking to you about California Thursday, and I'm excited to bring some more information to you about that during our wellness portion. Some spacing issues. We also planned and began an equipment replacement program this year. The biggest was our van. We got a new van at the beginning of the year, and we are proud to put our logo on it and see it driving around schools. So that is, it's been a nice addition to our team. We've also started replacing some of our outdated refrigerators and freezers. And then we also have put in place a rotation with warranty on our computers, so every year we'll be purchasing a certain portion of computers over a five-year period. We will have those all rotated and new for all of our sites and covered under warranty. The other thing that we're really excited about is our snack and our supper programs. They have increased greatly, and this slide here shows the participation in those programs and how we got that growth. Our snack program actually increased through more offerings. So we now offer our snack program at 6 of our schools. Those snacks are being offered to our students in some of the programs that Ansel talked about earlier, as well as music and a lot of other opportunities, work recess, that kind of thing. Our supper program, thanks to our ACEs, has also actually grown over 10,000 meals this year because we are now serving supper every day at both Bayview and Fault. So that has been a huge increase for our program, as well as offerings to our community. What that actually equates to is about $35,000 in new revenue for us. So not everything is beautiful. We looked at that last slide. We saw lots of growth. In this slide, we're looking at our breakfast and our lunch. If you notice, our elementary did grow just a little, by about 500 meals. Our middle school plateaued, and we lost in the breakfast in our high school by about 4,000 meals, which is significant. If you look at our lunch, our elementary has dropped and our middle school has dropped, but our high school has gained. So why are these things happening? It could be a scheduling issue. It could be that we're offering a second chance breakfast at our elementaries, and it's scheduled too close to the lunch. And so the kids just aren't hungry at lunchtime, so they're not coming in and eating. So those are things that we'll have to work on and look at over the course of the summer and how we menu our things next year. One of the other things that is significant that could affect this, of course, is our free and reduce. So that was some of the numbers that we were just talking about with Angela. And what I did here is I included our current free and reduce, which is in that second to the last column, and then I included our CBEDS numbers as well. The reason why I included those TBEDS numbers is because that's pretty much what the district bases their information on as a capture of that day. However, that particular day is prior to our children falling off of eligibility from the previous year. So if families have changed incomes, maybe mom or dad got a job, that will affect that free and reduced number as well as the CVEDS number. So, and one of the things that I shared, Chris had mentioned 42%. I noticed like the La Viega is right at that 42%. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at this slide, the free and reduced that we have current as of May is a good picture of what we're going to carry forward into 16-17. The other thing that's here that I'd like to draw your attention to is fall elementary. Currently, we sit at 70%. It has dipped all the way down into the 60s, 68, I think was its lowest this year. We run a program at Galt called Provision 2. Provision 2 basically provides us the opportunity to give every student a free meal. That was based when we were a lot higher. We were at 82% during our base year, which was 2012. We are now currently down to 70. It is not financially viable for us to continue Provision 2 and repeat a base year without further encroachment to the general fund. And so we have been working with Anne Mariah and trying to communicate with her community on how that would look for them next year and dropping the Provision 2 program. So, on to the budget, the fun stuff, right? If you look at this slide, you kind of look at the federal and state revenue, and you're looking at that budget line, you're thinking, oh my, what has she been doing? Those numbers are actually reflective of January. By the time we do our claim and we do our process, we submit it to the state, they send us our money back. There's quite a lag time for our money to come in. So when you're looking at the actuals, those actuals are reflective of January's claim. So we still have 5 months of income left to go. Based on that information, based on our participation, we will meet our budget goal. If you look at your local revenue, again, that is a reflection of the past. That is at the end of month of March. Our local revenues is our vending, our catering, our cash sales, our adult sales. So that's what's in that local revenue line. Again, that is as of March. We do anticipate actually exceeding that budget line. The biggest change for us is this transfer from general fund. In the past, this district has been very generous and given us $450,000 as a front load, so that we had the money to spend. This, as you can see, the money comes in slowly. This year, Mr. Monreal and myself wanted to take a different approach. And so we wanted to really pinpoint what it really costs to run our program. Instead of front-loading us that money and letting us spend that money and letting us use it appropriately, but then having some reserve and do you roll it over, do you take it back, those kinds of things are all kinds of questionable. So we decided to do something a little bit different. This year, so far, he's given us $150,000, which we were happy for, and we've used it. We do have a placeholder up to $200,000, and I'm hoping not to get there. We may. But that is significantly different than the $450,000 that we've received in the past.
And the kudos of that is when Amy and I first sat down and looked at this, our thought process was, you know, how do we really capture what the essence is of running this food services program, you know, based upon actual usage and trying to garner all the patterns that we had. So, as I mentioned jokingly, it was like, what do I expect from this guy? He's coming in brand new and we're changing the way we're doing things. But it was just trying to present the picture to the stakeholders and to you as the board and as Mr. Monroe, what it really takes to run this program, especially with all the changes that Amy and her team have really implemented, the level, the types of food you can serve, the requirements, et cetera, and for us to really present the picture of what it really does and what are the needs we actually have from a personal point of view. So again, it's part of tipping my hat to this young lady who is very, very well respected throughout the whole county for the way that she manages the food services department.
Some of the other things that we have really worked on is our staffing. Through retirement and through people finding other placement, we have reduced our salaries by about, I think it's around 11%. We're really looking at structuring the staff that we bring back on board based on the site need and what we need as a district. Instead of, in the past, it was you had this position, it was X number of hours. Whether we actually needed that at that site or whether it fit what our requirements were. So this year, as our staff is retiring, which is sad to see them go, we are replacing it with our need. The other expenditure savings this year is going to be in that materials and food line. We've worked really hard with our local farmers, and we've worked really hard with Central Coast Purchasers, which is a cooperative group happen to be the lead district of, to really find some cost savings in our food. And so this year, we will actually project to see about a 6% food cost savings, which is significant considering most food costs are going up. So what are our challenges? These have been challenges throughout this year, and I think that they're going to continue to be challenges. Absolutely. As we've all talked tonight about drop in enrollment, what does that mean? That also means a drop in free and reduced. And what does that look like for our participation, and what does that look like for our sites? We're still meeting our state and federal menu requirements. However, there is salt requirements that are coming on. There are sugar requirements that are going to be coming on. And so what is that going to look like for the food that our kids are eating? And how are we going to encourage them to still participate when they really want to go and get hot Cheetos and soda and things like that? And, of course, we talked about food costs and what that looks like. And then staffing. Some of the new requirements is that we're asking a lot of our staff. We're asking them to do professional development. We're asking them to do scratch cooking. We're asking them to do all those things that require some skills. And so we need to hire and retain good, qualified people. And we want them to be able to perform their jobs. So that's always an issue. And then, of course, we talked about the loss of provision, too, and what that's going to look like for us. So what is our goals, our continued focus? We want to increase those student sales, of course. That's always a goal. How are we going to do that? With drop-in enrollment through some innovative programming like the Smarter Lunchroom Movement. This year so far, we've seen a growth at Santa Cruz High of 20% in their lunch participation just by implementing some of those strategies. We're going to continue doing the cooperative purchasing. We've expanded our cooperative. We are now in our 12th year, and we now have 12 schools. We've expanded into milk, fresh fruit. We've done pretty much all parameters of food purchasing possible. We're going to continue to align our staff with the student populations. We're using some very measurable data so that we know we're serving our students, and we know that the employees can perform their job in the time allowed. We're going to continue to expand that catering and vending. I know I just talked with Molly, but he's like, those aren't my sandwiches. How come? And then, of course, we're going to work with our district teams. Trevor is a great resource. Curtis is a great resource. So within our own team, we're going to continue to use those resources. So now on to the fun part. This year, we launched California Thursdays, which was quite an undertaking and a lot of fun. It was something new for us, and we talked about it at our wellness committee meeting, the very first one, and they were very excited and wanted to jump in and start helping out, which was very needed and appreciated. So California Thursdays, if you don't remember, me standing up here. It was based on a simple premise that California students should be served healthy, freshly prepared California food. We were one of 58 school districts statewide that did participate in the Collective Action Day. They estimated that we served over 1.5 million meals. Personally, for Santa Cruz City Schools, on that day, we served 1,730
48 meals. And that's just lunches. We needed two more. There is a simple premise that we can all stand behind, and that our wellness committee also was definitely excited to stand behind, that healthier students are better learners. Through local purchasing, it helps our local economy. And with the smaller footprint of purchasing, it helps our environment. So I think those are all great qualities that we can all stand behind as a district and as a committee. The other thing was connecting our students to our farmers. A lot of our kids, there's some disconnect, and so they don't always know. And so we created these menus, and we have these up. We actually are participating in California Thursday every Thursday. Most districts are doing one or two Thursdays. If you're going to do it, you might as well do it all the way. So we did it every Thursday. So we have these signs up that will locate where the food's from, what county it's from, and then we're participating in the Farm to Fork program, and so we'll highlight farmers as well. So this month happens to be strawberries, and we have three local strawberry farmers with posters and information about their farms for the kids to read about. So it's kind of fun. And every family needs a farmer, of course. This bottom picture, I had the pleasure this fall of going out to Robin's Nest, which is a local family farm. She has 2 acres of Granny Smith apples, and I got to go and hang out with her and her son and size apples and walk her farm. We bought every single apple possible that she produced because the drought, there wasn't a lot. We do look forward to purchasing from her again coming this fall, and I think this year, because we've gotten some rain, we're hoping to get more apples. The kids really enjoyed them. The poster on the other side was actually on a farm table that we had on California Thursdays. We really wanted to thank our farmers and the people that made California Thursday possible. Watsonville Post Produce donated all of the produce that day for us, which was a huge cost savings, and they were all from farms around California, of course, California Thursday. But we've really tried to keep them local within our Central Coast, including the tortillas that came from Watsonville. We worked with CAF and Alba Farms to get a lot of organics. So there were four focus areas for California Thursday and for our event. One, of course, was the food. That was the huge part of it. So these are just some pictures. One of the plates we had Carnitas tacos, and we had some chicken tacos they could choose. They had lots of buffet line. They could go down and get fresh guacamole. They could get fresh. There were three different kinds of oranges. This here is the Car orange, which is from Orange Grove. And the kids enjoyed it. We involved a lot of our students. Down here is our student leadership, who were lifesavers that day. They came out, they helped us set up, they helped us serve. It was all hands on deck, and they really did a great job. The other thing that we did was we really wanted to incorporate our teachers and our staff for the day, and so we invited them all to come for free lunch. And there were lots of them that actually came up and enjoyed and hung out with the kids, and it was a really nice day. We also wanted to do some nutrition education. We used some of our community partners. So up in the top, you have Caitlin Manchester, who's with the Department of Health. She came out with a Rethink Your Drink game, and we had prizes, and it just educated the kids on how much sugar they're drinking in their drinks. We also had a team from the university come out, and they did juicing. They've actually come out for us a couple times now, and I believe they were doing a carrot, sweet potato, orange something or other. The kids love it. It's definitely a way to get them to eat things and drink things that they would never touch before. We also highlighted some of the crops that are growing locally that were in season. March is definitely a harder month for us. The fall would be great to have a California Thursday because there's more. But we focused on broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and of course carrots. And we gave them different samplings and different ideas of how to eat things. We did a Brussels sprout salad. We did not tell them that it was Brussels sprouts until after they tried it. Most kids loved it until we said, oh, yeah, you're eating Brussels sprouts.
Didn't you have the Brussels sprouts?
And then, of course, there was the physical activity and the fun. We had Kaden come and broadcast live from the quad and get the kids yelling and screaming and dancing and really having a good time. The girls were rocking out. We had some guys doing some line dancing. And then, of course, we have our very own Mr. Monreal and Boardman Vessel enjoying. I think that's the slapper, clappy hands. We had lots of giveaways and T-shirts to keep the kids energized and happy. And it was a really fun day. And there's my crazy staff, who also would not have, I couldn't have done it without them. They amaze me every time. Every time I turn around, they're doing something different and wonderful, and I didn't have to ask them to stay longer and help. They just pitched in and did what needed to be done. And every day, I'm very thankful for that team. So, any questions?
Sheila.
Well, this is a comment, not a question. I just was amazed to hear this presentation in terms of the efficiency
you
brought to the food service, the ways in which you looked at saving money and how you did it at the same time making sure you had high quality. I was amazed by it, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Deb.
My question is about the facilities master plan, and I'm just wondering, I know that the lunch line at the middle school continues to be an issue because we haven't been able to address the stadium-style walk-up windows, so just if that's built into it to improve that, because having a grumpy middle schooler who doesn't eat a lot at lunch, that's the number one complaint. And I've been hearing that since he was in kinder, before he was there, so I'm hoping that's something that we're looking at. Absolutely.
Oh, sorry. Claudia.
I'm kind of saddened by Galt losing their meal programs. Is there, how much does it cost us at this point with this, with the numbers going down? How much is it costing?
I could get those numbers for you. I wouldn't want to quote a number tonight, but I can certainly get that.
But it's quite a bit.
It is. And each year, as those numbers drop, it costs us more and more and more. It saddens me, too. It's a great opportunity for our kids to come in and not have to worry about money and not have to worry about those kinds of things. But at the same time, we do have a high grade reduced at that school. And the kids are still going to come and eat. That is our hope and our wish. And through our online and computer system, parents that do have to pay can put money online. And so it's not going to be a larger transition. They can come through, punch in their number, run their card, just like they do now, and no one will be the wiser.
Okay. Jeremy.
I also have a numbers question. You know, that 450 number has always been bandied about. It's become urban legend myth. So forgive me, I'm bandying it about. But it seems to me that we've reduced that by like down to 150 or something like that. So we're pretty much in a balanced budget, or we're very much moving in that direction. Am I getting this right?
You are.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Patty. Claudia, did you have another one?
So my question is on refrigeration and equipment and such. Are you moving towards where you will have adequate space for the type of refrigeration we'd like, so that things that environmentally are individually packed, and you know, I know juice components, it's been a very difficult piece all the way around. Do you foresee a future of moving away from that soon?
I think the straw issue, and I know that's it's been kind of a bug into everybody. It's difficult to answer those kinds of things because we do have to serve mass in limited time. We have to have it in a way that our children can drink it and it's sanitary. Ultimately, yes, if I can find a juice that's out there or something that would limit the packaging and limit the straw, limit the plastic, absolutely, hands down, that's going to be our first priority. However, we still have to accommodate.
We're not there yet. Okay. I'm just going to continually put that bug out there. But I would also like to thank you for this presentation and the depth of the work you've done, and also working to address to find solutions within your budget.
Thank you.
I so appreciate that. So thank you, Amy.
Didi, I'm going to go to Jim first and then your question.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on Member Tracy Blue's comment. And yes, we've heard a lot of comments from all stakeholders regarding the lunch and the servings and the areas there. They are being addressed by the architects of the ring back as part of their overall master plan. And kind of addresses number three's question is we continually look at what we have right now, knowing that as we continue this path of information and bringing up what the needs of our district, what can we not really band-aid but continue until we get into a full growth pattern for facilities. So we're trying to be very cognizant of that. I'm still trying to meet the needs that Amy and her team has, but at the same time, as Trevor and I discussed, you know, we don't want to put new light fixtures in there to be pulled out in 2 years. We want to make sure we're doing that in conjunction with all of our projects.
Dee Dee?
I also just want to thank you so much for your conscientiousness in thinking about our children's health and the value of the products that you offer to our students and for us as parents. It makes a huge difference. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there comments from the public?
Okay, thank you very much, Amy. Is that Jim?
Yes, thank you, President Thompson. This is a follow-up from our previous meetings talking about one of our summer facility projects that we've had back before the board that were approved. This next step is meeting with the Santa Cruz City Schools Board, the resolutions for the issuance of the 2016 summer Muni League Certificate of Participation. As you'll see in the information that we provided, we have gone out to bid for the vendors. That was done by our financial advisor and his team. We came back in, Brandis and Palmer, which happened to be our placing agent through the same bank in North Carolina that funded the so-called high school field replacement, came in as the low bidder at 2.02% for the district itself. And this will be funded with funds specifically outside of the general fund to fund this project, with the intention of it being, as Member Shonen pointed out at the conversation with the facility bond. If not, it would be funded by Fund 25, which is our developer fee fund, and Fund 21, which would be secondary redevelopment agency for facilities. So staff recommends to approve the resolution for this piece to move extremely fast forward with the summer projects.
Do we have questions?
Are there comments from the public?
Writing these things.
Do we have a motion?
Move approval.
Second. Jeremy and Patty.
Thank you.
Student recommendation?
Aye.
Roll call?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we are going to adjourn this meeting, and in a two-minute break, we're going to reopen for the finance authority meeting.
The game. We're down by 5 at halftime, but you know, 5 is nothing
five
for
is
us
nothing
at halftime.
For us.
That's right.
And Steph's doing okay.
You know, that doesn't tell me that. It just like just.